This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act capped out-of-pocket insulin costs for seniors on Medicare at $35 a month. A UW-Madison researcher tells us how that's affected access to the life-saving medication. Now, President Biden's son Hunter has been embroiled in controversy throughout his father's time in office and before. He has a history of substance abuse, has been scrutinized for business dealings with international firms in places like China and Ukraine, and he's facing criminal charges for tax violations and illegally possessing a firearm. A plea deal in the tax cases fell apart at the last minute just a few days ago. He's provided a target for Republican criticism against the president, rising to the level of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy floating the idea of an impeachment inquiry to investigate Biden family finances. A House Oversight Committee has already launched an investigation into Hunter Biden's alleged tax crimes. One of his former business partners, Devin Archer, met with the committee today behind closed doors. President Biden has stood by his son despite the negative spotlight his scandals have brought to the administration. We're learning more now about the investigations into Hunter Biden's activities and the politics surrounding them, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the controversies surrounding Hunter Biden? Do you think about these controversies? How do you think Congress should handle the investigation? What do you think of this plea deal that's, at least for now, delayed at best? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of multiple books, including Presidential Swing States, 3rd edition. David, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, and thank you to the audience for listening.
And we've got a lot of ground we can cover. David, let's start with the charges in this court case now. We had what looked like a plea deal done. The judge says, no, hold on. We don't know what's going to happen next there. Can you give us the background on those specific criminal charges against the president's son?
Well, the president's son has a variety of charges he faces, including illegal gun possession, questions regarding some drug possession, and a few other assorted ones. But for the core, I think the core issue, what we're really thinking about here is something really fascinating, is that they reached out and negotiated a deal. That is the prosecution and his attorney. And rarely do we see a judge second guessing a plea deal. And what we saw happen last week was a judge that said, listen, the deal that was received here that you guys negotiated, I'm not sure this is appropriate and wants to review it. So this is highly unusual in terms of what we're seeing and where it's actually going to unfold at this point, because it's possible that a lot of other charges had been, let's say, thrown out or negotiated out that could involve some questions regarding, again, we don't know a whole scope of it, but they could also include some things in terms of tax fraud, because that's one of the other charges he was pleading to, some like minor, you know, tax evasion and so forth. So we don't know the full scope that could have been out there, but needless to say, a judge second guessing a negotiated plea is very unusual.
Now let's look at the investigation here. This was started by a U.S. attorney named David Weiss, a U.S. attorney in Delaware, appointed in the Trump administration, approved, got bipartisan support, and entered that office, initiated this investigation under the Trump administration. A lot of times these U.S. attorneys, they are asked to resign when a new administration comes in. The Justice Department says, nope, you stay, complete this investigation. I bring this up because there's accusations that David Weiss, the attorney here, was playing softball in the Hunter Biden case. What are your thoughts on his role in this investigation and the plea deal, now rejected, at least for now, plea deal we ended up with?
Well, first off, it is unusual for U.S. attorneys to stay on when administrations change, or at least when, let's say, there's a change of party. It was probably smart on the part of the Biden administration not to dismiss him and put somebody else in place. It was an effort to try to at least create some sense that there was any type of partisan activity going on. Having said that, there are allegations from some whistleblowers and from some individuals within the Department of Justice that were claiming that even though he carried on from the Trump administration, again, some allegations that perhaps the investigation receive some political pressure, that he did softball it a little bit. And I think this is where, or perhaps maybe the judge's concern, although I'm not sure, but putting aside partisanship for a few minutes here, in terms of it, this may be a legitimate question for Congress to look into regarding whether or not there really was any kind of improper pressure that was placed upon the prosecutor. And on the face of it, it doesn't look like there was, but I think until that's completely answered, I think we're going to have a variety of questions from the judge and perhaps from a lot of people in Congress and maybe public opinion wondering how this deal got negotiated down to where it's relatively minor in terms of what he's being charged with and what he was going to plead to.
Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University of Law at the University of Minnesota, looking at criminal charges against Hunter Biden, the president's son, a plea deal rejected by the judge, members of Congress, the House Republican majority also starting investigations. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about this? What do you want to see from Congress when it comes to investigating Hunter Biden and the Biden family finances? Is this something you want to see Congress spending time on or not? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, there have been accusations from Democrats in particular saying these Republican investigations in the House, it's just a political fishing expedition, an election year, President Biden running for re-election. On the other hand, as you were just pointing out, this is the sort of thing that Congress is there to do, to investigate the executive branch and make sure it isn't bending the rules on the behalf of favorite individuals, the president's family or otherwise. What would you hope for the best kind of investigation to come out of congressional committees, given all that?
Well, what you would hope is that, again, there would be a truly bipartisan effort to try to figure out what's going on in this case. One would hope that the Department of Justice would be forthcoming in terms of providing witnesses and any other information. I mean, it may turn out on this because there's an ongoing, at least until there's a plea deal, there's an ongoing legal case going on here. Some of this might not be able to take place in public, because, what if, for example, they're doing the investigation and the plea deal falls apart and we have to go to trial or something like that? Issues regarding what materials would be aired in public become problematic if there's going to be a trial going on in this situation here. But if I could take a step back,
sure.
If we can go back to really the 1970s, and it takes us back to when we had Archibald Cox, who was fired by Richard Nixon in the Saturday Night Massacre, who was trying to investigate Nixon in terms of what was going on in Watergate. We created this provision called a special prosecutor, which was supposed to be insulated from, let's say, presidential influence. And by the time we got to the inquiry into Bill Clinton, people soured on the idea of an independent prosecutor. The law expired, and we don't really have anything like that in place anymore. And the reason why I mention this is that take us back to the Trump era, take it back to now, to Biden right now with Hunter Biden, there is an ongoing problem that we discovered 50 years ago. How do we actually investigate possible criminality that involves the executive branch or people related to the executive branch? And it may be that we need to be rethinking whether or not there is some type of special prosecutor law or some other system set in place. Now, granted, with Nixon, it was about criminality within the executive branch. No one's making, at least at this point, any allegations of criminality within the Biden administration. But rarely, I can't think of a situation off the top of my head where we've got a close family member of the president being investigated by the Justice Department. And this raises potentially the same types of conflict of interest issues as investigating criminality within the executive branch. So I think what I would really love to see out of this is something broader in terms of, is there a better process or policy that we could put in place more permanently to address allegations of criminality, and so that we don't have this constant sort of partisan bickering that's going on here.
Yeah, you point toward a big difficulty in American government. You've got the Attorney General, who's the head of the Justice Department. They're appointed by the president, confirmed by the U.S. Senate. In a case where they have to investigate that president or people close to them, technically the president is still their boss. And it sounds like you're saying we haven't quite figured out a way to insulate them from that kind of potential for interference.
No, you're absolutely correct. And the whole idea of having the special prosecutor law when we had it is that that person would be appointed by a judicial panel and subject to presidential removal only for bad behavior. But otherwise, the president would have limited control and the special prosecutor would have pretty broad independence. And in an ideal world, of course, we would live in a world where we never have to worry about criminality within the executive branch, that everybody's beyond reproach and doing their job, you know. But unfortunately, realistically, we're all human, and things happen like that. And so we do need a better process. And I think the lesson that we're learning in the last 25 years, let's say since the Clinton administration, since the special prosecutor law expired, is that this very ad hoc approach may not be a satisfactory way of handling it. And we do need to go back and say, okay, what worked, what didn't work from the old special prosecutor law, can we improve it? And can we come up with a better system in terms of how we handle this?
We're talking to political scientist and law professor David Schultz about Hunter Biden, the politics of the criminal and congressional investigations into the president's son. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way Republicans have handled the Hunter Biden situation? Do you want to see further investigations into his conduct? Are you ready for the case to wrap up and move on? Do you think this will be an issue for voters to think about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, hey, and what do you think of David's suggestion? Bring back some kind of really independent special prosecutor for situations like this. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to look at the legal and political implications of ongoing investigations into President Biden's son, Hunter. A plea deal fell apart last week in a criminal investigation. Congressional committees led by House Republicans looking into the matter as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Gene is with us in Milwaukee. Gene, hello.
Hello. I'd like to know why Hunter Biden is not part of the government. So why is Congress investigating him? Why not just a regular DA?
Gene, thanks for the call. Private citizen Hunter Biden with obviously prominent family connections. Why is this a job for Congress, David?
It's a job for Congress, I believe, because there are possible allegations that perhaps the president used his influence or, let us say, the machinery of government to try to either mitigate the investigation or in some way, shape, or form affect the investigation. And that I think that is the basis for what the Republicans are looking at. Now, should the Republicans be doing, or the House, I should say, in general, be doing their own inquiry into illegal behavior of Hunter Biden? No. I think the nexus, the hook, if I could use that phrase there, is there something going on in terms of how a criminal investigation by the Biden administration, may have been compromised because it involved his son?
Thanks a lot for that call. Gene, we'll go to Deborah now in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I really don't care what Hunter Biden did. What he did does not affect the presidency. It doesn't affect the government. What I would like to see Republicans do is actually govern, do what they were elected to do, pass, maybe do something about climate change and health care. That's all I have to say.
Deborah, thanks for the call. And there's a Politico article out there, David, with a lot of Republican members of Congress who seem to agree with Deborah saying, yeah, we're not hearing much about Hunter Biden from our constituents. We're hearing about economy, the border, and crime and things like that. Your thoughts, David, putting on your political scientist hat now instead of your law professor hat, the political impact of all of this?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because one of my friends who works actually at Minnesota Public Radio used to use the phrase inside baseball. And it was a phrase that she used to say, these are the issues that people who are like the real political insiders or that very small percentage of the population truly care about. And polls are suggesting that's exactly the issue, is that if you, and again, these are polls, this is less my opinion, but if you're looking at public opinion polls at this point, the public is concerned about what? They're concerned about inflation. They're concerned about the economy. Republicans are concerned also about a range of issues that might include also abortion, et cetera, et cetera. So this may be an issue that the political insiders, those within Washington, D.C., find really intriguing. But right now, it does not look like it's really generating a lot of public interest or public support. At the same time, and I was actually giving a talk this morning about this, is someone asked me a very similar question, and I said that this person said, well, isn't this on parity with investigations into Trump? And I said, even if it were, Trump so much consumes the news cycle that it's not the Hunter Biden story is just not the main story for many people. And if Republicans are thinking that this is going to be the way of taking the focus away off of Donald Trump and his legal problems or other issues, again, the polls are not suggesting that that's a good bet.
Thanks again for that call, Deborah. A lot of the way our politics seems to work these days, David, is that there are stretches, especially coming into a primary election season, where the interests of the base, the hardcore members, supporters of a party who are definitely going to come out and vote in a primary, their issues can matter a lot. Could this be part of what's driving interest in the Hunter Biden story, in this case, the Republican base, who may feel very strongly about this?
I think you're absolutely correct in that situation here. I'm going to even narrow it. Again, if the polls are correct, the base cares about it. But even among the base, if you were to ask them and say, okay, rank order the issues that you think are most important to you, this probably, even among important issues, probably doesn't come in first, second, or third, or fourth. And so even among important issues, it's a lesser ranked type of question. But there's no question that probably for the talk radio, for the social media, for the hardcore base, this is consuming a lot of their chatter at this point. And this is probably what's generating in part the congressional interest in terms of talking about it.
We've heard House Speaker Kevin McCarthy float the idea that, hey, maybe we need an impeachment inquiry to look into the Biden family's financial dealings. He seems to have dialed that back a little bit. Implications from some members of his caucus that they're worried, oh, maybe if we keep looking, we'll find that some money went to then Vice President Biden at some point. What do you think of the notion of an impeachment inquiry to dig further into these issues and claims?
Well, first off, I'm going to bet a quarter with any listeners out there. And my bet is going to be that there'll be an impeachment inquiry and there'll be an effort to try to impeach Joe Biden, simply because in sort of our tit for tat political world, I think many members of Congress, Republicans in Congress, would like to be able to have an impeachment hanging over Joe Biden going into 2024. And if they can get the votes to actually get an impeachment vote and then force the Democratic-controlled Senate to have to do something next year. So regardless of the merits, and again, and you'll notice how I'm saying here is that I don't know where the investigation would go. I've not prejudged it at this point, but I would say I think it's more likely than not that we will see momentum later this year and especially going into next year for an effort by the Republican House to try to do an impeachment. But right now, it does not sound like they have the votes to be able to pull this off. And even if they do, again, it becomes a question of how does this play out politically in 2024 when I think voters are looking to the Republicans to say, okay, tell us where you stand on reproductive rights. Tell us where you stand on the economy. Tell us where you stand on Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. It may not be a winning issue with the independent voters and the general public, but again, it might appeal to the base.
WPR will not facilitate that wager, David. You're on your own time on that one. Got you, just for another minute or so, expanded the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case, a couple new indictments related to allegations that President Trump, former President Trump by that point, ordered security tapes to be erased. Does this change much in terms of the wider investigation?
It adds additional charges. I think it now brings the charges against Donald Trump in that instance from 37 to 40. It's yet another obstruction of justice. It implicates another person in who was, I think, arraigned today, although that person didn't plead today because he didn't have an attorney. It probably doesn't significantly change the calculus down in the Florida investigation. It just adds more to it. But what I do think is a possibility is the fact that we now have another one of his subordinates, you know, who's been charged. One always has to wonder at some point, will there be a plea deal with a lesser person? You know, I can't remember what the person's title is now. And would this person now be willing to take a plea in terms of implicating Donald Trump? This becomes the complication. And then one other thing which has emerged is the fact that Donald Trump has raised quite a bit of money, but he spent nearly $40 million of his campaign funds on legal expenses. This is just going to be more legal expenses and more time that's diverted from him in terms of his campaign.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you, to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today to talk about the president's son, Hunter Biden, and the congressional and criminal investigations into his conduct. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, from cities and states to the whole planet, we keep breaking temperature records in recent years. A NASA researcher joins the show to say we need to take action to avoid the potential for a climate collapse. You can join in with your thoughts and questions. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Two Food Fridays ago, we talked about mocktails, zero-proof cocktails, whatever you want to call them, and our guest mentioned the growing number of zero-proof alternatives to many spirits, your vodkas, gins, whiskeys, and so on. Last week, I mentioned that I had bought a zero-proof bourbon, makes sense, I like bourbon, and I'd report back after I tried it. Well, here's my report. I was going to make something with it. I did a test pour and immediately realized it had cinnamon in it, which I get a weird reaction to, not like a dangerous allergic reaction, but long story short, I'm better off not consuming cinnamon. It appeared as natural flavor on the label, like it always does. Sadly, there was another zero-proof bourbon right next to it on the store shelf that I didn't get because an online review specifically mentioned the cinnamon. So, I can't tell you whether or not it's good. If you like cinnamon, you might like fake bourbon. I don't know. There is good news. I have a friend I can give it to, so it's not a total waste. If you have tried zero-proof spirits, love to hear what you thought. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Inflation Reduction Act put a cap on out-of-pocket insulin costs for Medicare recipients. Did that lead to more people getting the medication they need? A Wisconsin expert digs into the change and what it means for people with diabetes. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about local music.
For a lot of folks in Madison, going to concerts on the square is a summer tradition. For some people, the classical music by the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra is the highlight. But for WPR's Bridget Bowden, the best part is a song called Home to Madison.
Picture this. You're sitting on a blanket on the Capitol lawn in Madison. It's a warm summer evening, and you're listening to beautiful classical music. You're feeling very fancy, sipping wine and eating cheese. But at the end of the concert, when you start to pack up your blanket, you hear this.
Mm-hmm.
This is Home to Madison, and it's not fancy. It's basically a country song. They play it at the end of every single concert on the square. And honestly, I love it. I mean, just listen to these lyrics.
Grilling brats on the barbecue. Friends and laughs and hey, what's new? I'm coming home.
So I wanted to know, what is the deal with this song? Where did it come from? And why do they play it here, of all places? I caught up with Andrew Sewell, the musical director of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, to hear the story. He says it all started with Madison's sesquicentennial back in 2006. They were putting together a time capsule and wanted a signature song to describe Madison. They asked for songwriters to submit entries.
And we got it down to four finalists. And I just wasn't particularly enamored with any of them. And I thought, I know that we can do better than that.
So he called up a friend of his, an electric violinist named Tracy Silverman.
He said, hey, Trace, we've got this thing. Could you just write, say, maybe a 3 or 4 minute song about Madison?
A few days later, Silverman sent a demo of Home to Madison. The judges loved it so much that they made it the fifth finalist, added it to the time capsule, and of course, started playing it at concerts on the square. Silverman lives in Nashville now, but he does have roots here.
You know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I have to admit, this is kind of on the DL, but I grew up in Beloit, not in Madison. But I spent a lot of time in Madison as a kid.
So he says finding inspiration for the song was easy.
You know, I learned how to drive a car, you know, on the country roads outside Beloit. And it was usually my job to grill the brats, and I'd have a grill full of brats just up in flames because of all that, you know, the way brats do when they grill. And all of that stuff was just in my mind.
Musically, he says he was going for something easy and fun to listen to.
I was kind of thinking John Cougar Mellencamp or something kind of like that, just sort of real straight up the middle kind of something that everybody would like.
The chorus is easy to sing along to, including my personal favorite lyric, just off Highway 51.
I'm coming home. Just even though nobody really calls it Highway 51, but it rhymes with Madison, so, you know, sort of.
Silverman knows that it's not the most serious song in the world, but that's the beauty of it, he says.
You know, if I lived in Madison as an adult, I might have had a much more nuanced view of the politics and the economics and all various things that are could be problematic and that people discuss as adults. And I didn't have any of that to burden me, you know. All I had was going swimming in Lake Mendota and stuff like that.
He says of all the music he's ever recorded, this song is probably the one that the most people know, thanks to concerts on the square. And he feels good about that legacy.
I couldn't be more honored to have the tune in people's minds as they're leaving that great venue and feeling like, you know, this is their home.
WPR's Bridget Bowden brought us that story on the unofficial anthem of Concerts on the Square, Home to Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Home to Madison.
Now, the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act capped the out-of-pocket cost of insulin for seniors on Medicare to $35 a month. Here's what President Biden had to say about it during this year's State of the Union.
But every day, millions need insulin to control their diabetes so they can literally stay alive. Insulin's been around for over 100 years. The guy who invented it didn't even patent it because he wanted it to be available for everyone. It cost the drug companies roughly $10 a vial to make that insulin. Packaging and all, you may get up to $13. But Big Pharma has been unfairly charging people hundreds of dollars, $400 to $500 a month, making record profits. Not anymore.
A UW-Madison professor is out with new research documenting the rising cost of insulin and how the cap is affecting seniors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on insulin? Are you on Medicare? Love to hear your experience. Have you seen a difference with this price cap in place? if you use insulin and you're not on Medicare. What are you seeing when it comes to the costs of this medication? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rebecca Meyerson is an assistant professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's talk about, before this cap, what were we seeing with insulin prices for Medicare recipients and I guess for everyone?
Well, this particular change only affected Medicare Part D beneficiaries. And in many cases, they did have insurance coverage and median spending was a bit over around $50 per month or so. So that, for many of these folks, it may not have been a big change. But that said, the amount spent out of pocket for insulin across all Medicare enrollees has really skyrocketed from about $200 million in 2007 to more than $1 billion in 2020. And a lot of that is individuals who maybe newly diagnosed. There's a lot of change in insulin need and diabetes prevalence. In total now, over 3 million Medicare beneficiaries do use one or more of the common forms of insulin.
Let's dig into your research now. Can you talk about how you tried to figure out the before and after impact of these caps?
Yes. So we took a look at data from IQVIA's National Prescription Audit. So that includes about 92% of retail pharmacies, 70% of mail order and long-term care facility pharmacies. So it's a pretty comprehensive data set. We looked at over 14 million insulin fills, and we compared trends from basically before the policy came into effect, which was January of this year, so September through December of last year, compared those data with what we see after the policy came into effect, which was January through April of 2023. And we used a study design that compares the changes in a group that was affected by the policy versus a group that was not affected by the policy. So given that there is nearly universal Medicare coverage at age 65, we thought that people who are age 60 to 64 who didn't have Medicare Part D would be a nice comparison group because they were likely to get it soon. So we compared, they were our comparison group, and we compared that with people who had just potentially just recently gotten Medicare coverage, people aged 65 to 74.
And then what did you find when it came to, you know, are people actually getting insulin prescriptions filled before and after and comparing those two age groups?
Yeah, so we had two main findings. First, it does seem like more people are getting their insulin for $35 or less, which is the new cap for people with Medicare Part D insurance. There was an increase in our group of 65 to 74 year olds of about 50,000 more prescriptions being filled with that cost or less to the patient per month. And that's about a 10% increase relative to before the policy. And the other main finding was that about 20,000 of those fills, so a little less than half, would not have taken place at all if it weren't for the policy. So that's about a 6% increase relative to baseline. So what that means for us is how we interpret those data is that this was helpful for people who were purchasing insulin anyway, despite the higher price. That meant they could have saved some money that could go to their other needs. And then there were also quite a lot of people who seemed to be foregoing insulin or not able to fill their prescription because of the cost.
And then for that slightly younger age group, people knocking on the door of Medicare eligibility, but not quite there yet, what were the trends for them? Because it could just be, hey, everybody is seeing the same kind of change. What did you see when you looked at that comparison group?
Yeah, absolutely. So one interesting thing about this policy is that it was enacted in January, so starting, you know, calendar year of 2023. And in January for patients, that's when deductibles reset for those patients who do have a deductible. And what we saw in the data is that in previous years, and also for those slightly younger individuals who didn't have Medicare Part D yet, there's a drop in insulin fills between December and January as people are more exposed to cost sharing. That's the time of the year when people are the most exposed to cost sharing because it's likely they haven't met their deductible yet. And so that drop actually was eliminated for those with Medicare Part D insurance only after the policy. So we saw that drop in January, just like the 60 to 64 year olds, if you look at the previous calendar year. But for that 2023, we no longer see that drop.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I'm 66 years old, and I do not have Part D because I can't afford it. So I have to pay out of pocket over $150 a month for insulin, and there is no break for me anywhere. I've tried. I've talked to my doctor. I've talked to the pharmacy. There's no break. I've got all these receipts. I'd like to get my money back somehow, but I'm kind of stuck.
Mike, I'm so sorry to hear that. Best to you as you try to figure that out. And Rebecca, you made an important distinction earlier. I had just said people on Medicare have this cap. People on Medicare who have Part D, as Mike mentioned, he couldn't afford Part D. So this cap doesn't affect someone in Mike's position. Do I have that right?
That's right. There are, and possibly in part in response to this policy, in March, there were a number of manufacturers that announced that they will be voluntarily capping insulin costs. And one of those was effective immediately with a coupon that can be downloaded by anyone. The others, I think, are coming into effect in 2024. But I wonder if there might be some relief out there, but it's true that unfortunately this policy that we were studying was only for the Part D beneficiaries.
Mike, thanks again for calling. Hopefully there will be some relief coming your way. We're talking to Rebecca Meyerson, assistant professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison. She has some new research on a Medicare insulin price cap for people on Medicare Part D, how it's affecting seniors. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you on Medicare, Medicare Part D, receiving insulin? Have you seen this price cap kick in? What did that mean for you? Are you not on Medicare Part D? Whatever age you are, what are you seeing when it comes to the cost of insulin? How has it changed over time for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Rebecca Meyerson, assistant professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison, looking at insulin price caps and their effect on Medicare Part D recipients. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by those price caps? Are you on Medicare D? You use insulin. Did you see this change? What did that mean for you? Do you use insulin, but you don't have that coverage? What are you seeing yourself pay for the insulin you need right now? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this, your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls. Matt is with us in Lodi. Matt, hi.
Hello. I just thought I'd share my situation. A few years ago, I went into the doctor at my wife's urging, and they did some tests. I had an A1C of 12.3. And so I was diagnosed type 2, put on the insulin and metformin, and I didn't like the side effects or having to deal with the medication. So I took it upon myself to radically change my diet. And I was, in my situation, was able to go from 12.3 to 6.2 and stay there over the next 3 years just by switching my diet. So I sometimes wonder if having federal dollars pushed towards nutrition versus the drug companies might not have a better outcome both in health and in cost for everyone that is in this situation.
Matt, thanks for the call. I'm glad that worked out for you. For some people, I think with type 2 diabetes, that could be an option. Rebecca, people with type 1 diabetes are pretty much going to need that insulin, as I understand things. But what do you think about Matt's comments, thoughts on prevention investment, nutrition investment, compared to putting money into prescriptions?
I agree. I think both are important. I agree that federal dollars should also go into nutrition programs that is definitely part of, for example, the diabetes prevention program is something that's covered by Medicare. That's for people who whose HbA1c is would qualify them as being pre-diabetic, and that is a program that actually has been shown in a randomized trial to save money by preventing progression to type 2 diabetes, and lifestyle modification is a big part of that. So definitely commend that emphasis as well. But I agree with your point, as you were just mentioning, that some people really do need insulin, absolutely, to stay healthy.
Matt, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Rebecca, this new research we're talking about fits into, I think, a wider long-term interest of yours when it comes to, you know, the impact of things like cost and access on people being able to get healthcare, in this case, prescriptions. Could you connect to this particular study to some of the wider work you've been doing on how we get access to healthcare we need, whether it's prescription or otherwise?
Certainly. So we've also been looking at the Affordable Care Act and how that provided options to people with chronic conditions, whether that be the number of people with diabetes who have gained access to health insurance. We saw increases in that over time and slight decreases when there are the gains of in coverage for people with chronic conditions. After some Trump administration efforts to undermine the marketplace. So that seems like that's been something important, as well as the Medicaid eligibility expansions. That's a policy that's been in Wisconsin, we only did a partial expansion that was not using the federal dollars. So that's something that states that did take that on have seen an increase in diabetes prescription fills. And also just people being able to use and afford newer medications for their diabetes, whether that be medications that are more expensive but have a better side effect profile or are better for their concurrent comorbid conditions as well.
Talking to Rebecca Meyerson, Assistant Professor of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at a change in insulin rules for people who are on Medicare Part D, saw more people getting their prescriptions filled and paying less for them. People who are on Medicare Part D, you can still join in at 800-642-1234. Now, this is still early days, Rebecca. What are you looking for? What are you going to be watching moving forward when it comes to this Medicare Part D cap on insulin costs?
We'll be watching for a few different things. So first, insulin being so crucial for the health of people with more advanced type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes, where we will be looking for whether this change in prescription fills helps avoid complications by looking at hospitalization data, mortality data. We'll also be thinking about whether saving money on insulin helps people be able to afford their other medications, or, you know, seeing what other benefits people are experiencing as they're saving money on this important medication. So we'll look for spillover effects to what other medications they're able to fill now, just like how we saw that in the Medicaid eligibility expansion work. And then finally, we'll take a look at who benefited the most from this change, interested to see which geographic areas, which income brackets, et cetera, really benefited the most from this change.
And you mentioned some producers of insulin saying, okay, yeah, we'll match or at least bring down our prices more in line with this Medicare Part D cap that you said many companies doing that starting next year. Are you going to be watching that closely to see if younger people with diabetes are going to have lower costs?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that would be very important. Originally, as the Inflation Reduction Act was being worked on, there was the hope that commercial insurance would also have this cap. That ended up, of course, not making it into the act. But a good number of states have enacted a similar policy. So another way to look at that would be to look at the effects of the caps that would also affect the younger and commercially insured population in those states that chose to enact those, and that's mostly been happening since about 2020.
We'll leave it there. Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rebecca Meyerson, Assistant Professor of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the impact of federal price caps on monthly insulin costs. still time for you to share your story, for better or worse. Have you seen the price of insulin change in your life? Have you been affected by these Medicare Part D price caps on insulin? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the new Oppenheimer movie draws on the story of the development of the atomic bomb and the secrecy surrounding it. An expert on nuclear history and nuclear development secrecy joins us to dig into the past, present, and the future of nuclear weapons. And you could join in with your questions, maybe if you've seen the Oppenheimer movie, questions based on what you saw there. And who's the biggest jerk in your workplace? What if it's you? How would you know? Find out how to figure out if you're the problem coworker. Central Time producers are a little too excited when I pitch that. I don't know. We'll see how that goes. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, there are a lot of ads for gold coins targeting seniors in particular, and that's putting some retirement savings at risk. We'll check out the results of a new investigation into gold marketed toward older Americans. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.